All right, good morning. Welcome back to the nightmare of differential geometry. And so we already know what a manifold is. So we have the stage. We have the players as well, which are the tensors. But in order to write down the field equations, we also need to differentiate these tensors. We need to, the field equations involve derivatives of these tensors and whatever evolution of these tensors. And for that, you need to differentiate the tensors. And I was trying to just, give you an idea that there are three standard possible ways how to differentiate tensors. And two of them we will not discuss in this course at all, which is the Lie derivative and the exterior derivative. And if you are interested in these, please take Ruth's course, which will be after Christmas, on gravitational physics. But basically, both these derivatives are sort of restricted. First of all, the Lie derivative is only possible along this direction u, so it only like differentiates along one direction in the space-time. You need to have the vector field u, and you can differentiate along that vector. It's like a directional derivative, if you want. The exterior derivative is super nice, doesn't need any extra objects, but you cannot differentiate the general tensors with this. For this to work, you need completely antisymmetric tensors. Okay, so it's good for f mu nu of the electromagnetic field, but it wouldn't be good for the metric, which will not be antisymmetric. So finally, the most ugly and the most difficult and very unclear derivative is this covariant derivative, which we will need to formulate Einstein equations. So let's do it, okay? So so we make an observation. And the observation will be that if I take a partial derivative of the scalar, so if you take d mu acting on phi of x, so the partial derivative, so phi is a scalar here. And the statement is if I do the partial differentiation of the scalar, this will be a 0-1 tensor. Is a 0-1 tensor. So partial derivative, when it acts on functions, it's a good derivative. Okay, it produces tensors out of tensors, namely out of a scalar 0-0 tensor, it produces 0-1 tensor. How do I prove that? Of course, I want to do d phi over dx prime mu phi prime. So this is how my tensor in the prime coordinates look like. But of course, I can rewrite this as dx nu over dx prime mu d over dx nu, acting on phi prime. But we know that the scalar transforms as phi prime is equal to phi, right? So it will be equal on phi. So then this is just dx nu over dx mu prime times d nu of phi. And you see that indeed the partial derivative of a tensor, the partial derivative of a scalar, transforms according to this matrix over here, which is precisely the transformation rule which you would expect for 0-1 tensor, for the covector. Okay, so that's what we discussed yesterday. Okay, so that's the proof that the partial derivative is good on scalars, and it's a good derivative. Okay, so why don't we try something similar, but now for a vector? Everybody happy with this calculation? Okay, so now take vector. And ask if, d mu of v nu is this a 1-1 tensor. Okay, can I use the partial derivative on a vector to create 1-1 tensor? Does the partial derivative? Create a tensor here. Okay, so for that, again, I need to ask how this transforms. So let's do v nu prime
d over dx mu prime.
Okay. So similarly what I have done before, so I can use the chain rule for d over dx mu prime.
So it'll be dx alpha dx mu prime d over dx alpha.
So that's what my d over dx mu prime is. I'm just using the chain rule. And then I want to rewrite the vector in the unprime coordinate. So I use the transformation
for the vector dx prime nu dx beta v beta.
Is this OK? Who needs catching up? Please raise your hand. I see you all writing and looking somewhere else. Should I wait a little bit? OK, let me wait 10 seconds. So by the way, while you are in Canada, you should go to one of these, parks, either the Ontario parks or national parks, which are here, especially if you like nature, and it's like super nice. However, so I wanted to go to Algonquin this weekend. However, there's going to be -4 and it's going to snow there, so it's probably not a good time now. But yes, you can go even in the snow, but then you better have a very warm accommodation there. And okay. Anyway, so very good. So partial derivative on scalars is good. It produces a tensor. But now if I do partial derivative on a vector, okay, so then what is the transformation of such an object? So now I just change the transformation. I just change the coordinates here. So I have mu prime, and then I have nu prime. D over dx mu prime is just by the chain rule this thing over here. And then v nu prime, well, I'm using the transformation rule for the vector, and this is what it is. So very good. So I have a derivative acting on two objects. So I use the Leibniz rule. Right? So this is equal to dx alpha dx mu prime. And then let's say I leave this one here, dx nu prime d over dx beta. And then I differentiate the second one. So I have d alpha v beta. So I'm differentiating the second term. And then if I differentiate the first term, I will have dx alpha dx mu prime d square x nu prime dx alpha dx beta v beta. Okay? So this is what I get when I differentiate the bracket. I have two terms using the Leibniz rule. So now let's look at the result which we got here. Okay, so this thing here, do you think this is good or this is bad? It's good. Why is it good? Well, if indeed this was a tensor, it would have to transfer a tensor with one component down, one component up. It would have to transform precisely in this way, right? So there's one matrix for this index up, is an inverse matrix for this index down, and this is precisely the transformation rule which you would expect. So this is what we want. What we would like to happen however, this is a problem. So this is an extra piece which spoils the fact that the partial derivative of a vector actually does not transform as a 1-1 tensor, okay? So this is a problem, and so then we have a contradiction. The partial derivative of a vector is not a 1-1 tensor, okay? Are there any situations when this will be a tensor? What do you think? Just looking at the equation which we got, do you think there will be any situation when partial derivative of a vector will be a tensor?
Where the second derivative is zero.
Uh-huh. And when does that happen?
Linear transformation.
If you consider linear transformations, namely if you are back to special relativity. So in special relativity, your Lorentz transformation is linear And so this thing here vanishes. And so then partial derivative is good. So problem, unless we are doing special relativity. Right? In special relativity and in precisely in the Cartesian frame, or Minkowski frame, this will be zero. And I only allow Lorentz transformation, which map my nice Minkowski metric to Minkowski metric. And then this will be OK, because this will go away. And then partial derivative is good. So this is what you were doing in special relativity. You were taking partial derivatives of tensors, and this was good. In general relativity, when you allow for general transformations, this is no longer true. So now, so to deal with this, if you don't know how to solve a problem, you ask your PhD student, right? And in this case, it was Riemann. PhD 1830. So he basically said, okay, I have to upgrade my partial derivative to something which, you know, is now called covariant derivative. So we have covariant derivative. And so let me put nabla mu acting on v nu. So instead of partial mu, let's put nabla there. And this will be given by d mu v nu plus a correction which will kill that other term. Okay? And the correction is precisely through this gamma nu alpha mu v alpha. Okay? So this is a definition of the covariant derivative. So you upgrade your partial derivative by adding an extra piece so that the transformation of this extra piece precisely cancels that unwanted term which you don't want over there. Okay? So for that, gamma has to transform in a certain way. Okay? Where? So gamma, of course, is called connection. It's called connection. And where this connection has to transform in a certain way, beta gamma, so the prime, gamma prime, in the new coordinate system, has to transform almost as a tensor, but not quite. So you see that this object has one index up and two indices down. So if I did write something like this, dx prime alpha, dx kappa, dx beta, dx prime, sorry, then there must be prime here. And then let me write it. D over x iota, dx prime gamma, gamma kappa delta iota. So if it's OK, so this is the transformation rule of a 1-2 tensor. So if it were like that, gamma would be a tensor. And of course, it wouldn't help me, because this would be then a tensor, but this is still not a tensor. I have shown that. So actually, gamma cannot be a tensor. And so there's an extra piece, which is this one here, dx squared x prime alpha dx kappa dx delta dx kappa dx prime beta dx delta dx prime gamma. Okay? So this is the transformation rule of gamma. So again, you know, this piece here would be okay for 1-2 tensor. But this piece, with the second derivatives, spoils it. So this is the spoiler. Well, this spoiler is precisely designed in such a way that it cancels that second piece over there. Okay? And so any object with three indices, alpha, beta, gamma, in this way, which transforms in this way, is called connection. Okay? This is the general connection. Questions? Does this make sense? So again, if I'm in special relativity, this piece will be gone. The second derivative piece is gone. And the connection transforms as a tensor. So in special relativity, if you use connection, it will be a tensor. And this is what allows you to for example, write down, as we discussed yesterday with somebody, basically like spin 2 field theory for gravity in flat space. Okay, you just use this connection, that's your tensor. And you work with this tensor. You can write down the action for that, and you can write down the gravitational classical field theory in flat space. Okay. But if you are not in special relativity, this thing here makes gamma not a tensor. And then we will have to deal with some problems later on, as we shall see. Okay? So gamma is not a tensor. Although it looks like a tensor, has three indices like this. So not everything that has an index has to be a tensor. Okay? So this is not a tensor. This is not a tensor. But non-tensor, non-tensor gives you tensor together. Okay. Very good. So by the way, if you want to transform, so this is how derivative acts on a scalar. So on a scalar, we just take a partial derivative. So covariant derivative on a scalar is the same as partial derivative. Okay. Then we know how the covariant derivative acts on a vector. And the statement is that this is enough to know how the covariant derivative acts on anything else, on any other tensor. Right? So in particular, and why is that? It's because you require that this is a derivative, which means it's linear and it obeys the Leibniz rule. Okay, so in particular, if you want to differentiate a covector omega nu, what you will find is that this is equal to partial derivative of omega nu minus gamma mu nu, omega, gamma, and gamma here. Okay? So the statement is now I can use the same gamma, the same connection, to differentiate also covectors. But the betrayal is that there's a minus sign here. Okay? There's a minus sign. And also I sum over a different index, right? So now I'm summing over the upper index. Before, I was summing over the lower index here. Okay, so this is how the derivative acts on a covector. And if you want to prove this, well, how would you do that, right? So proof, and let's do it very schematically. Well, you can take a product of the two things. So why don't I take a covariant derivative of B mu, omega mu, alpha, and alpha here, right? So V alpha, omega alpha, what is it? It's a scalar, right? It's a scalar. So then this is equal to partial B mu, V alpha, omega alpha, right? But at the same time, I have Leibniz rule. So let me just write it schematically, and you can put all the indices if you want later on. So what is this, right? So I first differentiate the V. So there will be partial plus gamma acting on V. So partial of V
plus gamma acting on V, very schematically, times omega, and then plus V, and it will be partial of omega, and then why there has to be a minus? Well, let's see, it's minus gamma omega. Okay, so now you see I have partial V omega, so partial V and omega, and then I have gamma V omega, gamma V omega, but I also have gamma V omega here with a minus sign. That's why there must be a minus sign. Okay, so these cancel, and then I have finally V d omega, which is d of V omega as I wanted. Okay, so that's why here must be a minus sign. And you can really derive this formula, which is over here, by putting the indices here. I give you that as a homework, if you want. Okay, it's a two-line calculation. Right, so that's why, if you know how the covariant derivative acts on a vector, and if you know how it acts on a scalar, you also know how it acts on a covector. Because you are using the Leibniz rule, and you are using linearity and stuff like that. So for any other tensor, it will act as a product of vectors times corresponding covectors. Okay. So for general tensor, so if you have nabla alpha t beta gamma, it will be partial alpha t beta gamma. Plus, now I differentiate this plus sign, the indices upstairs. So it will be alpha delta t delta beta. And we had gamma here. So we differentiated this index here, this index here. And you would have plus, you know, all the other things where the remaining indices upstairs. And then it's minus gamma. And we differentiate this index beta. And let's call it kappa t gamma kappa and so on. Okay. So basically, this is how it acts on any tensor. You just do a partial derivative of the tensor. And you put plus gamma times for every index upstairs and minus gamma times for every index downstairs. Questions? Okay. So let me make two more remarks regarding the connection. So connection is anything that transforms in this way, okay? If you look at this thing here, obviously it's not a tensor. But what if I anti-symmetrize beta and gamma, okay? What if I do gamma prime alpha beta gamma minus, well, gamma alpha beta gamma minus gamma alpha gamma beta, if I anti-symmetrize over the lower two indices, okay? Then if you do the transformation, you're anti-symmetrizing between beta and gamma. So this term here actually will drop out. And so the anti-symmetric part of the connection will transform as a tensor. It's a good and useful tensor. It's called torsion. Okay, so anti-symmetrized version. Let's see. Version of gamma is a tensor T alpha beta gamma and is defined with this minus 2 gamma alpha beta gamma. So now why is the 2? So this thing here is an anti-symmetrization thing. And what it means is like you take 1 half of beta gamma minus gamma beta. Okay.
So this thing here is just gamma alpha gamma beta minus gamma alpha beta gamma. Okay. And this is called torsion. And there are theories where people consider non-trivial torsion. So not in general relativity. In general relativity, the torsion tensor will be set equal to zero. Okay, but if you go beyond general relativity, you think about string theory, so low energy effective actions of string theory, or if you talk about standard supergravity theories, where you have spinners also possible and so on, then the torsion will be non-trivial. Okay, so T is zero by assumption in GR, but can be non-trivial in string theory or in supergravity theories and so on. Okay. And what is beautiful about torsion is that people know what is the source of torsion, what is a physical source of torsion. So we will be writing down the Einstein equations, and the Einstein equations are equations for the metric. Okay. So, and the Einstein equation is basically like the matter sources the energy momentum tensor, and this energy momentum tensor sources the geometry. So it's really the energy momentum tensor which gives you the metric. Okay. So now, do you know what could be a source of torsion? Well, people know, but anybody, please tell me. Yes?
I think you mentioned to me that it's spin or something.
It's spin. So you know, once you consider fermions and stuff like that, fermions do have spin. So inside the matter, you can have non-trivial spin energy momentum tensor. It can be non-trivial spin. And it's precisely the spin which sources the torsion. Okay? So it can be and spin is the source of torsion. In the same way as energy momentum is source of metric. Okay, so you can write down another set of sort of Einstein equations which tell you what the torsion will be in the presence of non-trivial spin. Okay, so maybe, you know, knowing about torsion is not so stupid, because maybe, and people write articles about, like, can I actually measure non-trivial torsion and stuff like that, but typically it's only inside the matter, so it's difficult. Okay, but anyway, so yes. So torsion may be physically interesting. Questions? Yes?
It is zero in GR because we are not considering the spin effect.
It's a postulate of GR. So Einstein formulated the simplest possible theory, and he didn't really think about torsion. So yeah. But if you do consider fermions and if you play that game, you can have non-trivial torsion. If you have non-trivial spin, you will have non-trivial torsion. But in GR, we don't know how to deal with spin. Okay? GR, as formulated by Einstein, is not good for considering, you know, non-trivial spin. But Einstein didn't know about spin, right? So, okay. Very good. So let me finally formulate a formal definition. So definition, if you want. Covariant derivative nabla is a map which maps KL tensors to K L plus 1 tensors. So it creates bigger tensors by putting this extra index on nabla mu down there. Such that it is a derivative. So first, it is a derivative, which means it's linear and obeys the Leibniz rule. Okay, so that's good. Second property we need to know is that it reduces on the partial derivative on scalar functions. This is to partial derivative on scalars. That means covariant derivative of scalar is simply partial derivative of scalar. In order to do this calculation, what you really need to do is that it commutes with contraction. So they said like a contraction of Vn omega. So it commutes with contraction. Which means that if you have, think like here, you can either, if you want, differentiate this index and then differentiate that index later on, or you can just forget about these indices and differentiate the remaining indices there. So it's the nabla of t contracted, where already I forgot about that there is alpha alpha sum. Okay, so you can either, it doesn't matter what you do, is that, but you can differentiate that index and that index later on according to that formula which I wrote down, or you can forget about that this is already a smaller tensor where the alpha has been traced out, and I can do the covariant derivative there. And finally, it gives you the torsion, as we've seen. But you can also define the torsion in a different way. So we have, but it's the same way as you can convince yourself that it's just anti-symmetric part over there, is that when I apply a commutator of covariant derivatives on a function, which I really mean nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu, acting on that function, what you get is minus t alpha mu nu nabla alpha on that function. Okay, so it gives you the torsion in this way, and you can show that this thing here is exactly equivalent to that one there. Okay, and that's it. So that's what the covariant derivative is. So you need to know how it adds on scalars. This thing here, interesting. Yeah, you can take this as a definition of the covariant derivative. But it's just properties of the covariant derivative. Questions?
Is it unique?
In what sense? So any object, gamma, which transforms in this way, will give you a covariant derivative. Okay, so right? So it's not unique. So as long as you know this transformation is satisfied, I can have covariant derivatives with these properties. But it's not unique because I can have many, many objects like this. All right. More questions? Yes?
Can I start from these three points, like 4 points of definitions?
You should be able to. I never tried, but you should be able to. Yes, yes. You can take this as a definition, and in principle, you should be able to arrive at that. It might be discussed in Vault or something like that. Yeah. All right. So now something much easier. So we understand the connection, okay? So the connection is that object over there. It defines a torsion tensor, which may be interesting. Finally, let's return back to the key player, the metric. Okay, so part D will be the metric. So something familiar to everybody. So metric G is a symmetric non-degenerate zero to tensor. Okay, it's symmetric between the two indices. It has to be non-degenerate, meaning if you take it as a matrix, the eigenvalues will be all non-trivial, right? And it's a zero to tensor. So then people write it, you can write it in our notation as G mu nu dx mu dx nu. So because it's a metric, it's very special for GR. People don't write the tensor product. So let's put something like this, dx mu dx nu. They don't write the tensor product there. And because it's very important, it's a metric, people use a horrible notation. This looks like a distance between dx mu and dx nu, so they call it ds square. Okay? So again, a misuse of notation. So this is the right thing. It's a tensor, right? So this is the right thing to do. But then people use that. It's a very special tensor. It gives you how to measure distances. So people call this ds square. Why not? So that's the general metric. So now in GR, in general relativity, typically you would require this a 4x4 matrix, 4x4 matrix. If you live in four dimensions, you can go to higher dimensions as well. But what is important is that in GR, you require also some extra input on what is the whether the eigenvalues are positive or negative. So we live in Minkowski spacetime. We know that one of the eigenvalues in Minkowski metric is -1, and the others are +1, +1, +1. So you require more generally in GR that one of the eigenvalues is negative and the rest is positive. Okay, so we have three positive and one negative eigenvalues. And because of the signature, you don't really discuss Riemannian geometry, which is typically for all positive eigenvalues, but you discuss pseudo-Riemannian geometry, which is just to stress that one eigenvalue is negative. Okay, so from here we have pseudo Riemannian geometry. So what is that to stress is that not all the theorems in Riemannian geometry will be valid. For example, in the Riemannian geometry, if you take a vector and feed it to the metric, so you have G acting on V and V, this necessarily is either zero or positive, right? If the vector is non-trivial. Because of this one negative eigenvalue, you can have null vectors. You know them from special relativity. Null vector is something that has a norm equal to zero. So you can put G on K, which is K square as you know it, can be zero, but the vector may be still not trivial. Right? So then, you know, so that, just to stress, you know, that for example, we can have non-trivial vectors such that K square equals to zero. And that wouldn't be possible in the Riemannian geometry. It's because of the pseudo-Riemannian geometry, because of this strange signature here, right? So can I have non-trivial k such that k squared is equal to 0? This wouldn't be possible in Riemannian geometry. Okay, very good. So now you can make another definition. So we already seen one very interesting tensor constructed out of the connection, which is the torsion tensor. We have a covariant derivative. We have a metric. We can construct the corresponding tensor. It's called metricity tensor. And it's simply given by the covariant derivative of the metric. That's a definition of metricity tensor. Interesting object. Some theories going beyond general relativity consider non-trivial metricity tensor. Okay, the question is, what is the physical source of this metricity tensor? Okay, and I am not sure actually there is any clear answer to that. Okay, so what be the physical source of metricity? Okay, if you want to ever deal with theories where the metricity is non-trivial, please ask that question. Okay, come up with the answer. That would be amazing. Anyway, in GR, we set metricity equal to 0. Okay, so basically, if you act with a covariant derivative on the metric, then it will always be 0 for us, okay? If you want to go beyond GR, you can include torsion that has a clear physical source, is the spin. If you want to deal also with non-trivial metricity, well, you better come up with what the physical source of this metricity is, okay? What property of the matter would source non-trivial metricity, okay? Very good. So we have metricity, and then we can write down the key theorem for general relativity. So theorem. You can find the proof of this theorem in the lecture notes, but I'm not going to do it. So if the metricity is equal to 0, and so is the torsion, so if we set both these tensors equal to 0, then there exists a unique connection which is called Christoffel. And it's given by your favorite formula, which you already know from the first lecture or something like that. So it's gamma alpha beta gamma is 1/2 g alpha delta g delta beta gamma plus g delta gamma beta minus g beta gamma delta. Okay? So basically, if you set these two tensors equal to 0, then you are back to the grounds you already know from the first lecture. And this is what GR is actually using. So in GR, you will mostly see Christoffel connection. And it's given by this formula over here. The proof is actually simple, but it would take me half an hour, so let's not do it. So then we have a unique connection, right? And you can show that that connection will transform in this way if you want. It's a special case of this more general connection here. Questions? So now we simplified everything, right? So now we are back to the ground, which we already know. We are dealing with the metric and so on. So now let's, yes?
So when we derived Einstein's equations, we also assumed that the derivative of g mu is zero. So is that consistent with this?
So you will see. So there are various approaches to, you know, how to derive Einstein equations. So standardly, if you would just assume, yes, I don't have independent connection. The connection is always given in terms of the derivatives of the metric, right? So you start basically from the assumption it's this Christoffel connection, right? You plug it into your action and you differentiate with respect to the only field which you have, which is the metric, and that gives you the Einstein equations. So that's one way to do it. So now, more supergravity way would be, well, I don't necessarily have Christoffel connection because I can have non-trivial torsion. Then I treat gamma as independent field to the metric. So then I have to write an action which depends on both, on the gamma and on the metric, right? So now you have two sets of equations. You have Einstein equations and you have torsion equations, right? If you said that the torsion is equal to zero, the other set of equations becomes really the standard Einstein equation. So you can play these games, right? But for standard GR, you know, this is the connection, and the metric is the only field which is independent. The connection is already determined from the metric through this, and so the action will be only function of the metric, right? In standard GR. Okay, so we are back to lecture one. Very good. Let's go even further to the very beginning, to the equivalence principle. So let's write down a mathematical version of equivalence principle, or mathematical version of the. So the equivalence principle led to the fact that you can go to a freely falling frame where everything looked like in special relativity, where the metric was Minkowski metric and so on, right? Everything was falling the same way. There was no gravity whatsoever, right? So let's do a mass version of this now. We are equipped to formulate this very precisely. So let's return back to principle of equivalence. The mass version, if you want. And it states that at every space-time point, or more mathematically, at every point on the manifold which we consider, it is possible to choose coordinate system which will be called freely falling, as we called it before, freely falling, or local inertial system, back to what we have done in the first lecture, such that in this coordinate system, the laws of physics are the laws of special relativity, such that the laws reduce to special relativity, namely, more mathematically, is that the components of the metric at that point are equal to the Minkowski metric. Okay, so in this freely falling frame, my curve metric just becomes the Minkowski metric, but it's even better than that. You can also set the first derivative of the metric to zero. G mu nu alpha at that point is equal to zero, which means, looking at this formula, if the partial derivative of the metric is zero, so is the gamma. Okay? So gamma at p is equal to zero. And so in this freely falling frame, everything really be like special relativity. The metric is Minkowski metric, and there are no Christoffel symbols. Everything will move on a straight line and stuff like that. Right? So this is the statement of the equivalence principle in more mass way. Metric is just Minkowski metric. The first derivative of metric can be set to zero. Questions? Okay, let me prove this. But not really. Let me just, you know, give a hint that it might work. Okay, so let me start from a system where this is not true. Okay, so let's start from coordinate system, from coordinate system x alpha, where we have non-trivial g alpha beta, and we have non-trivial g alpha beta gamma are non-trivial. Okay. So then the statement is, let's concentrate on that point. And let's Taylor expand around this point, and let's do a coordinate transformation to a new coordinate. So and then do a coordinate transformation to new x prime alpha, so that, you know, this we want to have the equivalence principle there. Okay, where g mu is equal to eta and gamma equals to zero. Okay, so that's the idea what you want to do. And let's just see that this is possible to do. Okay. So we can say that the two coordinate systems x and x prime coincide at that point P. Okay. So then to the linear order in the distance from that point P, I can write that x prime alpha is just, I'm doing Taylor expansion, so A alpha beta x beta plus OX squared. Okay, so that's the linear expansion. So if the two coordinate systems, I'm doing Taylor expansion and x, so if the two coordinate systems coincide, I'm setting this x0 alpha equal to 0, right? So they coincide in the same thing, so they can be only rotated in the first case. Okay, but at the same time, I know that if I do the coordinate transformation like this, my metric transforms as a 0 to tensor. The components of the metric transform as a 0 to tensor. So it will be dx gamma dx prime mu dx delta dx prime nu g gamma delta. Okay. So, in order to calculate what this thing here is, I need to know how x is a function of x prime. So I need to invert this relation. Okay. So there will be a corresponding relation that x alpha is something like a times alpha beta x prime beta. Okay. Plus ox prime squared. So yes, you can do it this way. Right? You just invert this relation here, write it the other way around. And then once I do that, I can calculate what dx over dx prime is. Dx over dx prime is just this A tilde matrix. So this is equal to A tilde gamma mu A tilde delta nu, and then G gamma and delta. Okay. So now what is it I want? I want that in my new coordinate system, the metric is just Minkowski metric. So I want that this is eta mu nu. We want. Okay, so far so good. So this is what we want. So can I achieve this, right? So whatever the metric here I start with, can I do, you know, this coordinate transformation? Can I find these matrices so that this is true? Well, unless something really goes wrong, I should be able to, because I have enough of degrees of freedom in this matrices A. Why? So this thing here is 10 equations which I want to solve. So we have 10 equations which we want to make sure that they are valid. Okay? So this is our equation. We want to achieve this equation here. But how many degrees of freedom I have in this matrix A tilde? It's a matrix, 4x4 matrix. So 16. Components of A tilde to play with. So hopefully, by tuning what, you know, these components of this A tilde are, I can solve these 10 equations. In fact, I have more freedom in the matrix A tilde than I need. There's 6 more degrees of freedom, which will eventually become undetermined. So this can be done, hopefully. In fact, we have 6 more degrees of freedom. Why do we have 6 more degrees of freedom? So we done the coordinate transformation. We achieved that the metric is Minkowski metric. Is this done in a unique way? What can I do? What kind of transformation I can do so that I preserve the form of Minkowski metric? You can do Lorentz transformations. How many parameters are in the Lorentz transformations?
6.
So precisely, this is the freedom of Lorentz transformations. Or can still do Lorentz transformations. You see? Very good. So we achieved that metric at that point. Is given by the Minkowski metric. And you know, this is not done uniquely. I still have 6 more degrees of freedom. I can still do Lorentz transformations. Perfect. So we achieved this thing here. So then let's just do the counting argument. So this is about counting, really. Right? So let's see. So what about the next thing, right? What about if I go to the next order? If I go to next order, so that means
we have x prime alpha is a alpha beta x beta. We already fixed those so that we have Minkowski metric. Then we go to the next order. So we put b alpha beta gamma x beta x gamma plus ox cube.
Okay. If you go to the next order, we have these coefficients to play with. How many coefficients are there to specify? Ideas?
64.
Almost. So this thing here, look at this. This is x beta, x gamma. So it is symmetric in beta and gamma. So this thing here really makes sense only if it is symmetric in beta and gamma. So then there's 4 times 4, but it's symmetric, so it's 10 times 4, so 40.
40 components to play with.
Okay. But what is it we want to do? We want to set in the next order the derivatives of the metric or the gamma equal to 0. Okay, so let's look at the derivatives of the metric, g mu nu alpha. How many components do we have here? We want these to be equal to 0, but how many components do we want to set equal to 0? It's again metric, is it symmetric? So there's 10 components here, is an extra index alpha, so 40. So we want g mu nu alpha equal to 0. That's 40 equations to satisfy. But we have 40 components of B to play with. And if you're lucky, yes, we can set that g mu nu alpha equal to 0. That also can be done. This seems like an interesting game. Let's keep going, right? Let's do next order. So if we go to the next order, x prime alpha, this is fixed by requiring that the metric is Minkowski. B alpha beta gamma x beta x gamma. This is fixed. So this is fixed by requiring that g is equal to eta. This is fixed by requiring that partial derivative of g is equal to 0. So we go to the next order. Plus c alpha beta gamma delta x beta x gamma x delta plus ox to the 4. Okay. Again, this object here has to be symmetric in beta, gamma, delta. So now this is a beast. And who knows how many components the C has. It's non-trivial. So now you are asking, well, there's 4 here, so it's 4 times. But now you are asking how many of these things are there. And there's like 3 indices, but it's symmetric in all these 3 indices. And the indices take 0 to 4, 0 to 3. Okay. The answer is that's given by a Young tableau, which I don't know what it is, 4, 5, 6. And so there will be 20 of those. So this is given by 4 times 5 times 6 divided by 1 times 2 times 3, which is 20 of these. So the C's, C alpha, beta, gamma, delta, has 4 times 20, which is 80 components to play with. Okay? Look it up in Wikipedia, what the Young tableau is and what these things are. So anyway, so there's 80 of these objects here. So now, can we use these objects to set second derivatives of the metric equal to 0? What do you think? Can you also eliminate second derivatives at that point? Well, if you could, I would probably tell you in the theorem, right? So maybe we can't. Why? Why we cannot set that? How many of these are there? Anybody? 60, almost?
160.
Sorry?
Is it 160?
160, that's another guess. So how many of these? So this is symmetric in this thing here, right? So there's 10. What about this thing here? It's also symmetric, right? Because it's a partial derivative, right? It's also symmetric, so it's 10 times 10, 100. Okay, so this is 100 equations. But we now have only 80 components to play with, which means that maybe we can set 80 out of these partial derivatives equal to 0, but there will still be another 20 which are non-trivial. So half 20 non-trivial second derivatives of the metric. Even in this freely falling frame where we try to use our coordinates to the best of our advantage. Okay. Okay, 20. It's a magic number. We will see next lecture that there is an object constructed out of the second derivatives. Okay, which will have 20 components. It's precisely this object which carries, it's a tensor, it's called Riemann tensor. And it is this object which carries non-trivial information about these 20 non-trivial second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so this is how you express in a tensor way non-trivial information about the remaining 20. Right? Yes?
Sorry, can you say one more time how we get 40 new quantities when going to
set? Okay. Thank you for the question. So, basically, the question is, there are two questions. Can I set these things here equal to 0? Right? What does it mean? How many equations I have if I want to set this equal to 0? You know that the metric is symmetric in the indices mu and nu. So symmetric matrix, 4x4 matrix, has 10 components. So this thing here has 10 components. There's another index alpha, which runs from 0 to 3, so 4. So it's 10 times 4 components, I have to set equal to 0, okay? So it's 40 equations I have. On the other hand here, this is the freedom in, so I haven't specified what this metric, what this object B is, but the object has alpha, beta, gamma indices. Because I multiply by x beta and x gamma, this is symmetric in beta and gamma. So it doesn't make sense if this wasn't symmetric, so it has to be symmetric in beta and gamma, okay? So then this is again symmetric matrix. So it has 10 components. And there's another 4 here. So it's 4 times 10. So it's 40 non-trivial components in this object. So if I use these, if I fix these components here, maybe I can solve this thing here. Does it make sense? Perfect. Okay, so anyway, so we can conclude that yes, maybe we can actually extend this theorem a little bit more. So in that freely falling frame, I can make sure that the metric is the flat metric. I can make sure that the partial derivatives, the first derivatives of the metric are 0. And I can make sure that that only 20 non-trivial derivatives of the second derivatives of the metric are there. The rest is 0. These 20 will be encoded in the Riemann tensor, which means that my metric, that around my point, The metric is really, really Minkowski up to some Riemann corrections, which are, however, at the order of x squared away from the point P. Okay? Anyway, so that's the statement of this theorem. Very good. So now I haven't said a very important thing, which is what we have been saying all the time. Yes, if you have a metric, you have also an inverse metric. So inverse metric is simply defined in components as something when you add with the metrics. It's a matrix inverse of this normal metric. So it's delta, alpha, gamma. So this object here, again, people should be writing, in fact, it's like G minus 1, alpha, beta. They don't write the G minus 1. They just write alpha, beta, right? But it's a misuse of notation. It's an inverse matrix to G. So this object here, if this thing here is a 0, 2 tensor, this object here will be 2, 0 tensor. So it likes to eat forms, covectors, and produces a number, right? So that's how you define this thing here. And then, of course, you can use G and the inverse G to rise or lower indices at will. And so in the presence of the metric, you can define V alpha to be G alpha beta V beta. And so in this case, there is no really reason to distinguish between covectors and the vectors, because the metric can always be used to rise or lower indices.
David?
Yes?
I don't think we talked about how we construct G mu mu on a manifold. Is that like, is there a risk for doing that?
Sorry, how you construct G mu? No. So G mu mu is a tensor on your manifold. And that's something which you know, typically, well, from the differential geometry point of view, that's something that is given to you,
okay,
right? So for GR, you'll be constructing what the G mu nu actually is, finding it from the field equations, right? But it's like a tensor field which lives on your manifold, and how you get it, well, it's not a question of differential geometry, it's a question of the theory which gives you this G mu nu, and that will be given by Einstein equations.
It's something solved.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we can, you know, rise and lower indices if we have the metric. And really, then you don't need to distinguish too much between vectors and covectors and stuff like that. Okay. So now let me make a few very important comments for when we will be doing the variational principle and so on. So we know that the metric transforms in this way. The x prime mu alpha dx beta dx prime nu g alpha beta. Right? So this is how the metric transforms. It's a 0-2 tensor and transforms in this way. Now I can look at this equation as a matrix equation. There's one matrix G here. There's another matrix here. There's another matrix here. And there's another matrix here. So I have a product of three matrices on the right-hand side. Now I can take a determinant of this. Okay, so apply a determinant on that. And so what you will find is that determinant of G prime mu nu, typically just denoted by G prime, is equal to the determinant of this matrix dx over dx prime. Okay, so I have three matrices. So determinant acting on the product of three matrices is the multiplication of three determinants, right? So that's the basic property of determinants, right? So you have determinant dx over dx prime from here. But you have another one. You have determinant dx over dx prime. And then you have determinant of the metric itself, so let's call it g. So now, what is have you ever seen determinant of dx over dx prime of a coordinate transformation going from x to x prime? You take the determinant. Do you know how that is called?
Jacobian.
It's called Jacobian. Okay, very good. So this is called Jacobian. And I will simply denote it by dx over dx prime this way. So what you found is that g prime is equal to dx over, well, let me now reverse it. If I do reverse, this is dx prime over dx to minus 1. Okay? So this is dx prime over dx to minus 2 times g. This looks nice, but not really. So is determinant of the metric a scalar function? Is it a scalar? How would it transform? It would transform as g prime is equals to g. Well, it almost transforms like that, except there is this bloody Jacobian here with the power minus 2. Okay, so then this thing here is not really a scalar, but it's called a scalar density. So g is a scalar density of weight plus 2. So how does the scalar density transform? Is that if you have phi prime to be dx prime over dx to minus w phi, then you say that the phi is a scalar density of weight w. Phi is a scalar density of weight w. Okay, very good. So the determinant of the metric does not transform as a scalar, but it still transforms relatively very nicely. It transforms as a scalar up to some power of the Jacobian of the transformation. Okay. So now there is another very important scalar density, which is the volume element. Okay. So you probably remember from a multidimensional calculus that if you calculate an integral over one sum coordinate system, and then if you want to change coordinates, then you just do integral over dx prime. But what you also have to put there is the Jacobian of the transformation, right? So if we have dv prime, which let's say is d to the n x prime, then the measure has the Jacobian in it if I want to write it in terms of dx coordinates. So it will be dx prime over dx. That's the Jacobian of the transformation, dnx. So the volume element is also, it's not a scalar, but it's a scalar density. Okay. Now the scalar density is of weight minus 1. Okay. So W is equal to minus 1. Can I combine these two together to form a scalar? Well, maybe if I take the square root of the determinant, it will transform as a scalar of weight 1. And if I combine it with dv, which is minus 1, I will get a real scalar. So which means that the new dv, so let's call it invariant, meaning scalar dv, is simply equal to square root of determinant of the metric dv, or dnx, call it dnx, so now when I'm taking the square root, right, I better make sure that whatever is underneath the square root is positive. Is this positive for geometric? It's not, because it has one negative eigenvalue, right? So you have to take minus here. And so this thing here will be the invariant volume element. And so when we will be writing the action for things, right, so we cannot simply write an integral over dnx, but we also have to put a determinant so that this is a real scale. I don't mean it's real. Well, it is real, but it's a scalar. Scalar function. OK. Questions? This is so simple, right? So simple, just playing with the Jacobians. Okay. So similarly, you can show that the permutation symbol, as you know it, which you typically call Levitch-Witte symbol, which is the object which takes the values plus 1, minus 1, or 0, depending on whether you have distinct indices or, you know, what kind of permutations, is not a tensor in general relativity. It is a tensor density. And so if you want a real tensor, you can make it by putting the corresponding determinant of the metric there. OK, so let me just do a definition. So let, and let me use this horrible notation. Well, not really. Alpha, beta, gamma, delta be a permutation symbol Okay, which means alpha, beta, gamma, delta equals to I the plus 1 when we have 0, 1, 2, and 3, or even permutations of that. And even permutations. It is equal to minus 1 for odd permutations of that. Permutations. And it's equal to 0 if two or more indices the same entries are the same. Well, that's the standard permutation symbol as you know it. It's what you called Levitch-Witte symbol until now. Okay, so now what you can show, and it's shown in the study text in three lines, but let's not do it here, is this thing here is not a scalar. Well, it's not a tensor, but it's a tensor density. So it transforms as a tensor up to some power of the Jacobian. You can kill that power of the Jacobian by inserting the determinant of the metric. So the statement is that from here, you can build a real tensor, which is called Levitch-Witte tensor, and you can define it as epsilon alpha beta gamma delta to be square root of the determinant of the metric, and then this permutation symbol. Okay. So this is the Levitch-Witte tensor. This will transform as a tensor. You can also raise indices of this object. So then you will have epsilon alpha beta gamma delta. Well, you can either use the metric to raise the indices here, or you can use a different definition. And of course, the two have to agree. And it's 1 over square root of minus g alpha beta gamma delta. Okay, so this object here, the Levitch-Witte tensor, will transform as a tensor under coordinate transformation. If you don't put the square root of g, it will transform as a tensor density, so there will be extra power of the Jacobian of the metric. And if you are interested in the proof, please see it in the lecture notes, so you can do it yourself. Okay? Questions? So now, this is everything we need to know about metric. Next time, we discuss parallel transport and curvature, and finally, we are ready to do GR. Yes?
You read the minus sign.
Yeah, there's a minus sign somewhere. Yeah, there's a minus 1 over square root of g alpha beta gamma delta.
Yeah, so it's alpha beta gamma delta on the spin rotation system, but can I just transform it to the usual del x over del x? Or?
Del x over there.
Yeah.
So this thing here, the statement is this thing here will not transform as a tensor. So if I want to make like in a different coordinate system x prime, I'll put primes here. It will transform as a tensor up to. So there will be dx prime over dx and whatever. But there will be also the corresponding power of the Jacobian of the metric, of the thing. OK? Yeah.
So essentially, one will get something like a bunch of these matrices, but it becomes active with permutation symbols, so like a determinant or something.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. If you are so puzzled about this, we can do the proof next time. But maybe you can do it yourself, or just look it up in there. OK. Great.